Ms. Weisberg, welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our arguments on the constitutional issues overlap considerably with those that we pressed earlier in the Arrington case. And so for that reason, I thought I may just jump directly into the issue that Your Honor raised with regard to Clark,
please do,
since it's on your mind. So I think Clark recognized that a state may have a legitimate reason to channel evidence about mental illness to the insanity defense, as opposed to the diminished capacity defense. But that's not the reasoned decision that New Jersey has made. New Jersey has seen fit to maintain a diminished capacity defense, and having done so, having recognized it and kept it on the books, it would be arbitrary, it would be unconstitutional to arbitrarily gatekeep access to that defense by excluding relevant, competent, admissible testimony.
So you can eliminate it altogether, but you can't have gatekeeping requirements if you allow it?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that what the Supreme Court has said is that if the state itself has made a choice to take the defense off the books, so be it. That's their prerogative. But once we have...
Where does it say that in Clark? That second piece about allowing the imposition, disallowing requirements once you've allowed the evidence to come in.
I don't think that's necessarily raised in Clark. I think that's a sort of general principle of due process, right? That if there's a defense on the books, that a defendant has to be able to pursue any sort of species of evidence that is favorable to the defendant and that is competent, reliable, otherwise satisfies the rules of evidence. Otherwise, you have a significant due process problem. I also think,
a state can't impose a quantum of proof as opposed to an evidentiary rule that limits admissibility of certain evidence. The state can't say in order to prove this, to satisfy your burden on this defense, you need to show X quantum of proof, because that's too limiting?
No, Your Honor, I think that would be fair. I think they could do so. It would still, I think, raise certain constitutional issues that we'd grapple with separately. But having established both a quantum of proof and a defense itself, any evidence, no matter what kind, whether lay, expert, observational, et cetera, that sort of meets that quantum of proof that goes to, is relevant to the defense, should be admissible and then judged by the jury for its credibility and weight.
So because this is a constitutional argument, it would apply even if there was a statute, for example, that said expert testimony is required in order to get an instruction on diminished capacity.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, you know, to that point, it's helpful to look at some of the federal cases that I cited earlier, where there was no dispute about what the particular rules at issue meant, but the Constitution still prevails. And I think actually to correct the record earlier about what Guerin holds, I think it was suggested that Guerin would allow rules of evidence or procedure to trump the Constitution. Guerin held, exactly the opposite. It said, a court may consider rules of evidence and procedure designed to ensure the fairness and reliability of criminal trials, quote, but when the mechanistic application of a state's rules of evidence or procedure would undermine the truth-seeking function by excluding relevant evidence necessary to a defendant's ability to defend against the charged offenses, the confrontation and compulsory process clauses must prevail.
So a state court's decision that would require a particular type of evidence, expert evidence, in order to facilitate a jury's determination of a complex medical issue would be the equivalent of a mechanistic application of a rule of evidence or a court rule?
Only if the court at issue didn't consider, didn't perform the constitutional inquiry that I'm suggesting is necessary. So that kind of application could be reasonable if the court made a determination that that was the only way to ensure the reliability of evidence. But what I'm suggesting here is that an expert requirement cannot be necessary to ensure the reliability of evidence. And as the facts of this very case aptly demonstrate, lay testimony may well, if not often, occasionally, or even rarely, be sufficient to establish the quantum of evidence that's necessary to trigger the diminished capacity instruction.
But isn't that ultimately a circular argument?
Yeah, really? I take your point, but I don't think so. I think that certainly the statutory interpretation piece is important, but I think it's what is really important, what saves it from being a circular argument, is that it has to be on the state to identify its clear interests and to disprove that in any plausible scenario those interests couldn't be met.
But if a court were to determine that in order for a jury to make in the interest of seeking the truth, to make a reasoned determination on a complex medical issue, mm-hmm. the statute calls for expert testimony by virtue of the language in the statute. How could that possibly be the equivalent of a mechanistic application of a court rule blind to the constitutional issues involved?
No, Your Honor. It's certainly possible that a court could make that determination. It's just that they have to do so on a reasoned, searching, substantive constitutional inquiry. And at that point, it's not the mechanistic application of a rule. At that point, the court has considered the interests of the state, the countervailing interests of the defendant, has weighed those things. And I think that's what the appellate division and the trial court here failed to do. And what I suggest that in the process of Your Honor's doing, you will be undoubtedly sort of led to the conclusion that there are plausible scenarios. In fact, scenarios that closely resemble the facts of this very case, where lay testimony can be sufficient, and therefore a categorical rule, a generalization, would result in a miscarriage of justice in those individual cases. And that's a constitutional problem.
Counsel, you need not answer this question if it's a little bit outside the scope of what you came prepared to talk about. But for the purposes of this statute, how do you distinguish mental disease from mental defect?
I think it's an important point, Your Honor, and I suppose the fact that the word defect is used just gives us greater reason to doubt that the word disease refers to a specific diagnosis. Disease, that's a recognized medical term. Defect, that's not. There's no doctor, I think, that will say, you've got a defect and I'm treating you for your defect, right? You get treated for diseases and specific diagnoses.
So if it was just mental disease, you would be more comfortable tying that to a diagnosis. The addition of defect means you're less comfortable tying that to a diagnosis?
You know, it's not the sort of primary argument I'd advance about why disease doesn't necessarily equate to diagnosis, but I think it's some support in that direction.
But you see defect as broader than diagnosis?
That's how I read it, yeah.
And just can you give me just a one more 30 more seconds, 15 more seconds on where that breath comes from, how that breath is defined for you?
Sure. I mean, I think the idea is that to say that you have a defect of reason, that speaks to me to the sort of bedrock notions of moral accountability and criminal responsibility that are embedded in the diminished capacity defense. And so it tells me that, you know, legal insanity and psychiatric diagnoses can't be overlapping, that the category of legal insanity is broader than that. Otherwise, I think
But here it actually, the only use of the word defect, it has nothing to do with legal insanity, right? We're talking about diminished capacity, right, which is not the same as legal insanity.
I'm sorry, I may have misspoke, having both these cases in my mind.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's it, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ms. Harrigan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Defendant asks this court to restructure the diminished capacity evidentiary universe from a longstanding practical history of relying on the competent and reliable testimony of medical experts to a rule of law that allows a layperson's undisciplined and untrained observations of symptoms and behaviors to determine whether a defendant suffers from a mental disease or defect sufficient thereafter to negate the mental element of the crime charged. Defendant's proposed rule asks this court to sanction armchair expert type of testimony, which would only serve to confuse a jury and ultimately hamper a defendant's ability to have the jury properly determine the defense. In fact, nothing in any submission by the defense or their amicus aptly demonstrates to this court how lay testimony, without more, is competent, reliable evidence sufficient to garner the instruction. However, what is clear from defendants' arguments and their citations to many out-of-state cases that allow for just lay testimony is that lay evidence on a defendant's diminished capacity, exclusive of any professional explanation, never actually benefited a defendant because it was never deemed reliable enough or persuasive enough to satisfy the statutory terms of the defense to establish the existence of a mental disease or defect. Simply put, characterizations of a mental disease are not enough. A mental defect is no different than a physical defect. We expect medical testimony in courtrooms in cases where a jury needs to understand what a heart defect is. That is because a jury needs to understand why there's this type of flaw in the heart and why it matters in the case before them. A mental defect should be no different, and it should be treated no different. A jury needs to understand what a defect of the mind is. Linking observational behavior as symptomatic of that defect, and in criminal cases especially, how that defect affected the defendant at the time of the crime. That is what is necessary for a jury to consider if such a defect negates the mental element of a crime. And this is just not something that a lay person can speak competently to. What expert evidence promotes is adversarial testing to an allegation that a defendant has a mental illness. Human psychology is vastly complex. It's tough for mental health professionals to sift through observational behavior and symptoms and properly diagnose a patient. If it is complex and difficult for medical professionals, how can we then expect a jury to do the same, even a properly instructed one? What the defense is asking this court to do is divorce observational evidence from the medical explanation that makes it comprehensible. But the hallmark of expert testimony is to define or explain those terms that are beyond the ken of the average juror. Part of that hallmark lies in that expert's specialized knowledge and skill. In other words, mental health professionals play a crucial role in assessing and differentiating between odd behavior, which can be normal on its face, even if it's bizarre, and a genuine mental illness such that it negates a criminal mind. In conclusion, the issue of mental illness and the best way for our courts to garner evidence of a defendant's claimed mental illness is complex and multifaceted. Our legislature used the terms mental disease or defect to describe the type of evidence a defendant must put forward before a jury can be instructed on diminished capacity. Expert testimony is the necessary means to effectuate that legislative intent and to ensure that only competent, reliable evidence goes before a jury. And with that, I welcome the court's questions.
You just discussed that there needs to be a genuine mental illness to negate a criminal mind. That sounds to me like an insanity defense and not what we are talking about here. The statute here does not say that there has to be a mental illness. It says mental disease or defect, using two separate words on purpose, whereas the insanity statute only says disease of the mind, not disease or defect of the mind. And then it's talking about only if it's relevant to prove that the defendant did not have the particular state of mind, which is an element of the offense. So for example, if purposeful conduct is an element of the defense, and for some reason this defendant could not have had that level of purposeful conduct because of some sort of disability or some sort of defect of the mind, it doesn't seem like that is requiring that it is negating a criminal mind. It's not making the person not responsible for their behavior at all, like an insanity defense mm-hmm. would. It could just mean that there is a lesser charge that applies. So where are you drawing that in order to get a diminished capacity instruction, you need basically the exact same thing as in order to get an insanity instruction, and that you have to fully negate the person's criminal, you have to say that the person is not responsible for their actions at all?
Well, I think the statute speaks about it. It speaks to a mental disease or defect. So it speaks to a mental disease, just like disease of the mind is an insanity. So they're similar in what they're what the statute requires. As far as what I said about negating a criminal mind and genuine mental illness, I was speaking to what Your Honor spoke to earlier, which was malingering. The statute requiring a mental disease or defect, I believe, you know, and making sure that we have expert testimony that comes forward that says that that person actually has a mental disease or defect would prevent this sort of malingering that could go on when you do have these types of situations, especially in this case. I mean, this case, you know, the state would argue that there was some malingering going on in this case. I think as demonstrated by the testimony in this case, especially the jail calls. And so, you know, I think mental disease or defect is very specific. Our legislature chose those words. And I think in order to get to even get to the mental disease or defect, to get to the diminished capacity charge, a defendant must come forward and show that he has a mental disease or defect.
Did your use of the term criminal mind, was that a substitute for state of mind?
It might have been, Your Honor, yes. Maybe it was an artful way to say it. I apologize. It's to negate the mental state of the mens rea of the crime charged.
How are you defining the distinction between disease and defect?
Well, I think State versus Galloway actually does that very well, because State versus Galloway talks about, mental disease or defect, but it also talks to the evolution of mental health and how we understand mental health a little bit more, and how it includes syndromes and conditions and things like that. So I think mental disease, you know, you're speaking to the types of things that, you know, again, you would see in sort of an insanity case, but, you know, a disease of the mind. And then the defect, you know, you have those other things that affect the way people think, the way that people behave, that maybe don't rise to the level in the DSM or in the psychiatric community as an actual disease itself, but more of a syndrome, Asperger's syndrome, things like that, that still could, you know, if you're in the throes of the symptoms and behavior of those conditions and syndromes at the time of the crime, it could negate the mental element of the crime. And what you need is that expert that talks about the mental disease or defect, but you also need the second part of that, which is it needs to connect to the crime. So it needs to have affected the defendant's cognitive ability at the time of the crime.
So I understand that you think defect is broader, but I'm trying to understand where the line is drawn. If this is disease, if this is defect, right? Where is the line drawn? What stops something from being a defect? Now, you mentioned before a syndrome. So is it disease and then defect is syndrome, or is it syndrome plus something? What stops? What's the boundary of defect?
I think the boundary of defect stops where it affects your ordinary thinking, and, you know, in a criminal sense, it would affect your behavior or the way you were thinking at the time of a crime. And so I think there are syndromes. I think there are conditions, and interestingly enough, the model penal code, which is what our statute is modeled after, in the commentary of the model penal code, it specifically said that they weren't going to define mental disease or defect because they were going to leave that to the evolution of medical understanding. So I think defect is a little bit broader mental disease is basically what we know as mental disease, and defect is to make it a little bit broader, but that does not mean that the second part of the diminished capacity statute, the fact that it had to affect your cognitive ability at the time of the crime, is not part of that.
And you don't
Sorry, go ahead.
You don't just mean affects the way you think. You mean affects the way you think such that it precludes the formation of mens rea, right?
Correct. Yes. Again, at the time of the crime, because you can be sane or you can be not. You can have a mental health condition, a syndrome that doesn't affect you And then you can have, you know, the symptoms don't affect you on any given day. And then you can have that same condition or syndrome that does affect you at the time of the crime. And so that is where that connection, that is where the expert is needed. It's needed to say, this person suffers from a mental disease or defect. These are the symptoms of that mental disease or defect, and it affected him at the time of the crime. And so that's where that connection needs to be had and where an expert is most helpful and most necessary.
But it sounds to me like you're just conflating disease or defect in that it sounds like you're saying for a mental disease, there has to be a diagnosis. And for a mental defect, there also has to be a diagnosis. But it's, so how are they different? Well, if you have to have a mental health diagnosis for both, then why did the legislature choose in, the statutes are right one on top of mm-hmm. each other. So presumably they were aware of what was in both of them. And for insanity, it says that you need a defect of reason from disease of the mind. Mm-hmm. So just a defect of reason that is not from a disease of the mind is not enough. Mm-hmm. But then in 4-2, it specifically says evidence that the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect is admissible, thus seeming to imply that a disease or a defect is enough, doesn't say and that perhaps the defect of reason from above does not have to be from a disease of the mind. They can be two separate things. You can be suffering from some sort of defect of reason or a mental disease, and either one would suffice. But it seems like you are ignoring the or in the statute by saying that no matter what, there needs to be a diagnosis from a mental health expert.
No, I believe that, you know, reading the statute, I mean, I understand where you're coming from, Your Honor, but I think when you're reading the statute, a mental disease or defect, you know, you still need a diagnosis for both of those. You still need a diagnosis because it is a defect of the mind. I don't think you can divorce mental disease or defect, the defect part of it, from the mental disease part of it. I don't think the legislature said you had to have a diagnosis for this, but you don't have to have a diagnosis for this. And so for mental disease and defect, both of them speak to a flaw in the mind, and that you need specific evidence demonstrating that flaw of the mind, whether it be a mental disease or a defect, to demonstrate that flaw of the mind. Then it goes on further to say that it would negate that at the time of the crime, it needs to, you know, affect basically your cognitive ability to negate the mens rea. You know, so again, insanity is an affirmative defense, and diminished capacity is sort of a failure of proofs. And so defense. And so you still have to prove the mental disease or defect, the mental flaw. And I believe that's what the legislature meant. And I believe that the model penal code commentary that speaks to not defining mental disease or defect specifically to allow for medical advancement also speak to medical terms, medical disease or defect.
And maybe the difficulty we're having in defining these terms, mental disease or defect, is a reason why an expert should be testifying with regard to a mental disease or defect.
100%, Your Honor. That's exactly why. And again, I can't stress enough that mental disease and defect was purposefully not defined because we, you know, we have a robust scientific community now, you know, and we have a better understanding of mental disease than we've ever had before, a better understanding. And I think, again, that's why experts come into play, because, you know, with the advent of social media, and you have TikTok docs, and you have all of these, you know, you're going to get a jury that might not have the proper information on what a mental disease or defect is. And if they're not given that explanation by an expert explaining those types of things, they may apply what they know based on what they've heard. I mean, we, you know, schizophrenia to all of us maybe have different, you know, maybe multiple personality disorder, maybe auditory hallucinations. Obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, I regularly say I have OCD because I like to clean things, but that's not what OCD is. You know, that's not a proper diagnosis, not a proper understanding of what OCD is. And so some sort of the characterizations of these mental illnesses and defects that people have, or the ordinary juror has, will not suffice in determining whether or not that particular mental disease or defect negates the element of the crime that is before them. And that is why expert testimony is so crucial, especially in today's world.
Is the word defects a word that's used in psychiatry today? It strikes me as a vestige of the 19th century.
I believe so. I did read the DSM pretty, I mean, not the whole thing, but, you know, I did go through it as I was preparing for this. I didn't really see defect. Again, I think Galloway really sort of talked about how, you know, mental disease or defect can include these conditions and syndromes and things like that. Again, expanding that medical universe that we now have, and we now know that, you know, the schizophrenia, you know, that was the only mental disease or defect. Now we know that there's other there's other diseases or defects out there that affect cognitive ability. It doesn't just have to be a quote unquote disease. And I think that's what Galloway speaks to. And I think it speaks to it well. And it also,
in order for one to exist, you still need a diagnosis, a mental health diagnosis, but it can't be found in the DSM, because what's found in the DSM is a mental disease. Here we're speaking about something beyond that, mm-hmm. but it still has to come from a mental health diagnosis. I'm not sure that exists.
Well, the DSM is a tool that psychologists use and psychiatrics use, and basically it defines the disease, but it has, you know, a wide realm of behaviors and symptoms that they have to ascertain whether or not it fits into that. And so
I understand, but that's my point. If a psychiatrist or psychologist is only going to diagnose you with a particular condition if you fit the qualifications, and if you do fit them, that constitutes mental disease. Mm-hmm. Then what are we saying is a mental defect? You cannot possibly need to also have a diagnosis that you meet all of those same conditions in order for it to be a mental defect, because then they have collapsed into the same thing.
Well, I think, again, Your Honor, I think mental disease or defect is the same thing. It's a flaw of the mind. It is a flaw of the mind.
The word or defect here is just superfluous, and it would be the same if it just said suffered from a mental disease.
I think Galloway explains the defect. I think it allows for advance in medical technology to expand just from what we think of mental disease to allow for other things that we now know affect cognitive ability.
If a defendant was able to secure an expert that was willing to speak about a condition that they suffered from and speak to the defense entirely, would you be able to preclude that expert witness on the basis that a psychologist, a psychiatrist, some expert would not be willing to sign off on the terms mental disease or defect because they're not found in the DSM and allow them to provide an actual diagnosis that fits those labels?
Your Honor, I think that a medical expert that actually observed or, you know, had a clinical time with a defendant and, you know, they have all these symptoms and behaviors that maybe they overlap, because we know a lot of these symptoms, they overlap. And so maybe they're not able to specifically put their finger on something, but they are able to say those behaviors and those symptoms that they were experiencing, and they were experiencing those behaviors and symptoms at the time of the crime, and they affected cognitive ability, I think would satisfy, and you would get the instruction for diminished capacity.
But if the doctor was on the stand saying, I cannot agree to the word defect, that's not a word I recognize in my practice as a word that would fit with my diagnosis, could you argue then you can't qualify as an expert for diminished capacity?
I mean, I think the voir dire would have to be pretty significant there and be like, well, what do you think that the defendant has? Is it a mental disease? Is it a flaw of the mind? Is it, I think you could still get there without using the word defect. Again, you know,
that's the word in the statute.
It is the word in the statute. And again, I believe that when we look at that, it's a mental disease or defect that requires a medical diagnosis, no matter what you call it.
But it's disease still appears in psychiatric publications, and I believe in the DSM. Does it not? The word disease, leaving aside defect. I think there is a distinction
absolutely
between those
disease
two.
Absolutely is there, 100%. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, again, this is the type of evidence that needs to come forward, that a defendant needs to bring forward in order to garner the instruction. And they need to bring forth that they suffer from something, a mental disease or defect, and that has been diagnosed, because we have case law throughout, you know, from this court that, you know, we've had case law from this court that stated, there was a mental disease that was put forth, but was never connected to the cognitive, you know, to a, you know, diminished cognitive function at the time of the crime. And then there's been case law where there was never any mental disease. There was a hypothesis that there was a mental disease or defect. And so this court has said, you don't get, you know, you can't have either one. We don't have either parts of the statute. We don't have a mental disease. So how can we have these type of behaviors are just odd. And of course, that's what we have in this case in Mustafa, is that we had these odd behaviors. We never had a medical diagnosis. There were medical records. Those medical records were introduced at sentencing. And the state, as it said in its brief, stipulated to those medical records coming in, but they didn't benefit the defendant because there was malingering that was in there. And so that wouldn't have benefited the defendant. It wouldn't have negated the element of the crime. And so those were not admitted into evidence. And so, you know, in this case, you have odd behavior, no doubt, but it did not rise to the level where the trial court erred in deciding that it did not meet the elements of the statute. And so he did not get the instruction. But that does not mean that the jury didn't hear it. The jury still heard it. Not only that, he got an intoxication instruction, which the jury did not believe, and they convicted him of the murder.
Would the state have made any other arguments if a diminished capacity defense would have been incorporated here, given the fact that obviously the state succeeded in convincing the jury that, you know, that there were no issues related to the defendant's ability to form the intent here?
You mean absent more proof?
Sure.
The state basically did argue that, you know, that the there was a notice of diminished capacity at the beginning of the case. And this defendant came forward. Actually, I think there was insanity also. And this defendant specifically said he didn't want any mental health or affirmative defenses. And he withdrew the insanity defense. And so trial counsel said within the record that there was this understanding that there would be this diminished capacity. I didn't see that in the record. I think there was an understanding that there was an intoxication that affected. He took amazing amounts of Adderall that particular day, very much over what he was supposed to take, and that that caused a temporary psychosis. But again, the intoxication instruction is the one that fit that particular factual scenario. And so I believe the state would have absolutely come forward and said this, especially after the jail calls, that this particular defendant absolutely does not suffer from any diminished capacity. He knew exactly what he was doing. And so, yeah, the state would have pushed back against that.
I want to come back to the phrasing of the statute. It uses the disjunctive or mental disease or defect, as mm-hmm. we've been describing. And when you run through those four words quickly, it sounds like it's one term. Is it actually two? Mental disease or mental defect?
I would say so, Your Honor, because there's an or in there. But again, both of those.
So your position is both require an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And assume that your case is stronger when it comes to mental disease. Would it make sense to say that an expert is required for mental disease, but not for mental defect? Would that in effect mean that defendants would come forward and say, oh, no, I'm not suggesting I have a mental disease that negated mens rea, I'm just suggesting I have a mental defect?
I think that would be problematic, Your Honor, absolutely. And I think you need a diagnosis for both. Again, Galloway talks to syndromes and conditions, and those are things that still need to be diagnosed. They're not something that a lay person can say, yes, that person has this condition.
It seems like many courts have decided otherwise. So it seems like, unlike in the context of the insanity defense, where there's only, I think, two court cases that anyone can point to, and then there was discussion in the previous case about whether they had substantive decisions on this, that here there's 25 states that recognize a diminished capacity defense, only five require expert testimony, six have explicitly held that no expert testimony is required and that lay testimony is sufficient. So are you saying you believe that all of those cases are wrong or poorly reasoned?
Again, evidence, relevant evidence of diminished capacity is admissible. It is 100% admissible. Whether or not it's...
I think the holding was that the defense does not require expert testimony.
Sure, does not require expert testimony. And again, a defense can come forward and decide not to bring forth expert testimony. It's not required. But in those cases, and especially in the cases that the defendant cited to this court to stand for their proposition that lay testimony is sufficient, not one single one of those cases, the lay testimony met the standard for disease or defect for the instruction to actually be given. So yes, the defendant can come forward, but how does it benefit?
In all of these six jurisdictions where they say that lay testimony is sufficient, they're not saying that?
They're saying that lay testimony is admissible and sufficient to come forward, but they're not saying that. I don't know what specific cases you're talking about, but I'm not sure. I would wonder in those specific cases if the instruction was actually given to the jury. You know what I mean? Because that's the problem. You can come forward with lay testimony. You can come forward with any testimony. It's relevant evidence. It's a low standard. What does it meet the elements of the statute? And the elements of the statute require a mental disease or defect, and that it's that mental disease or defect, that person was being affected by that, is cognitive ability at the time of the crime. And so if a lay person cannot speak to either one of those. And so I would question whether or not any of those states that just allow for lay testimony actually have a situation where diminished capacity was given to a jury.
And that's for the other states, excuse me, if I can follow up. Do the other states use the term mental disease or defect in the way that the New Jersey statute does? Mm-hmm. And if so, do they follow this pattern? Either lay testimony is admissible as to both to satisfy the standard, or expert testimony is required as to both? Do any split the baby?
Your Honor, the cases that I looked at, you know, you had a mixture, kind of like this state does. You know, you have the expert testimony and you have the lay testimony. The cases where it was just lay testimony, the cases that I read, the instruction never went to the jury. It was never sufficient enough for the instruction to go to jury. They never met by just the lay testimony, it never met the elements of mental disease or defect sufficient for the instruction to go to the jury.
And out of the 25 jurisdictions that do recognize diminished capacity, 13 haven't answered this question, just like we haven't. New Jersey hasn't answered this question. So it's really the 5 that require expert testimony and the 6 that don't require expert testimony. So it's really not, in any sense, a majority of cases that have even answered this question of whether expert testimony is required or not.
Right.
So it's really 6 out of 25 that have stated expert testimony is required. 5 out of 25 have stated it's not.
Right. And I think you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I think the reason why is because probably most of those cases, there is an expert. Most of the cases that you look at for diminished capacity, there's an expert. Because it doesn't make any sense for the defendant not to bring forward an expert, because they're never going to meet the mental disease or defect part of the statute. And so, and they're certainly not able, I mean, you can get mom to get on the stand and say, my son suffers from schizophrenia, but can she then speak to whether or not at the time of the crime that his behavior negates the element, the mens rea of, you know, in this case, purposeful for murder. She can speak to one thing, but she can't speak to the other, which is why an expert is necessary per this statute.
Counsel, I'd like to explore conceptually some of the rationale of the trial court, and specifically an aspect of the trial court's decision where the trial court said that diminished capacity is not necessary because the murder charge sufficiently addresses the mens rea requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would seem to me that if you accept that rationale, that it would read diminished capacity completely out, because the charge is always going to describe mm-hmm. the mental requirement or mental elements or for the crime that's being charged. And so just conceptually looking at the trial court's decision, doesn't that rationale that you don't need a diminished capacity charge because the elements of the crime are already established in the charge, doesn't that read out the concept of diminished capacity?
I think I understand Your Honor's question. I understand where you're going. I think in the context of Judge Falsitano's reasoning in that particular instance was that he had denied the diminished capacity and said that there wasn't sufficient evidence to give the instruction, but that and defense counsel was speaking to all of the testimony that was organically found in the record, so to speak. And so the judge, I think, was speaking to, well, the charge of mens rea for purposeful is sufficient for them to be able to determine whether that odd behavior or all of those things negates that part of it. That's how I understand it, Your Honor.
Won't that always be the case? And if that is always the case, what purpose would diminished capacity have?
No, Your Honor, because specifically in this particular instance, the judge had already weighed the evidence and decided that diminished capacity would not be charged, that the defendant had not met the elements of the statute to be able to garner the diminished capacity. If a defendant brings forward evidence that satisfies the statute, mental disease or defect affects cognitive ability at the time of the crime, he gets the instruction. If he doesn't meet that standard and the trial court decides that that standard hasn't been met, then the typical, you know, then the regular mens rea of whatever charge that the defendant has is what the jury hears. And then whatever evidence is found inside the record, they will then determine if that negates that mens rea. What Judge Falsettano said at that particular time after, if I'm understanding where you're at in the record, Your Honor, is that he had already denied the diminished capacity and said, don't worry about the mens rea. The jury's going to get instructed on mens rea. The evidence is in the record, and they're going to be able to decide whether or not he's met that mental element.
Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
Your Honor, I would just simply say that, in this particular case, the trial judge did not err in deciding that that defendant had not come forward with enough evidence to garner the instruction. There was no error. And I believe the appellate division also ruled correctly in this case. And we would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you. Mr.
Thank
Clark.
You.
May it please the court. I'd like to address some of the court's questions. The Attorney General does not believe that there's really any significance in the distinction between mental disease or defect. Really, it's, does the defendant suffer from a condition which has the capacity to affect negatively their capacity to form mens rea, and did in fact affect negatively their ability on the date when the criminal act occurred? And in our brief, we cited a couple of examples of defects, epilepsy being one, intellectual disability being another. And intellectual disability, I think, is interesting for the fact that it comes in degrees. There are four different degrees of intellectual disability. And the briefing on the other side, respectfully, seems to assume that delusions is sufficient to get the jury instruction here. And that's simply not the case. The DSM recognizes that delusions exist on a continuum. They may be related to a psychotic condition that underlays the delusions, but they may not. Ordinary, normal people can function normally and yet have delusions.
How does that square with the language of the statute? If you're requiring that there has to be a mental disease found in the DSM, and we already discussed that 4-1 specifically provides that you have to be operating under a defect of reason from disease of the mind. So there I agree with you. You have to have an underlying disease of the mind. And if you do have any kind of defect, it has to be caused by that disease of the mind. Then 4-2 comes directly after it. And the legislature could have copied the exact same language, but instead they said suffered from a mental disease or defect is admissible, thus implying that here the defect does not have to be caused by a mental disease and can be something that is broader than a mental disease and does not constitute a mental disease.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Pardon me. Our footnote on epilepsy, the Epilepsy Foundation, takes great pains to say that epilepsy is not mental illness. They're very concerned about that. And the Law Commission commentary indicates that the term defect is meant to include congenital and traumatic conditions that are not necessarily illnesses, so that it broadens the category of conditions that may be relevant to the state's ordinary burden of proof, which is to prove mens rea and the commission of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, you started by saying that you don't think there is a distinction between disease and defect in the statute, and now you are defining a distinction.
I'm saying that the distinction is inconsequential, Your Honor. Either a defect—
Is that inconsistent with sort of general canons of statutory interpretation? That if the legislature chooses to use different words, there is a purpose or a reason behind that choice?
Yes, Your Honor, and the purpose is to broaden the category of conditions which may be shown to be related to the defendant's ability to form the mens rea required.
So they do mean two different things.
Absolutely. What we're saying is in either case, whether it's mental disease or a defect, you still have to make the causal link. For instance, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but the movie Sling Blade, Billy Bob Thornton.
Missed that one.
He was a person with intellectual disability, and yet he murdered a person in that movie. And we cited some cases that have held that people with mild or moderate intellectual disabilities may nevertheless have the mens rea required to violate different statutes.
Is defect, we know that the setting of this language is from, you know, close to 200 years ago, or at least has it evolved from or migrated from England. Is defect a word that you would really expect a psychiatrist to use today?
Your Honor, we don't believe that it's necessary that a psychiatrist testify to a defect. However, whoever the expert is, they need to be able to establish that the condition that the defendant suffered from had the capacity to and did in fact.
I understand, but what I'm saying is, what I'm suggesting is, shouldn't the focus be more on disease, given that the word defect, which has a pejorative aspect to it, at least historically, may be a word that is perhaps not used today with respect to mental illness?
Your Honor, that's why I tried to use the word condition. It's an existence of something for which the individual is not blameworthy, because really the model jury charge on diminished capacity instructs the jury to weigh specifically whether the person had a condition for which they're not blameworthy and whether that had the capacity to interfere with or prevent them from having the mens rea necessary to violate the particular statute. And so, again, here, delusions. Many older people, the DSM study found that older people are more likely to believe that their relatives are trying to steal their money. Now, that's considered a delusion. And yet, many of those people would be considered perfectly normal in virtually any aspect of life. So that it may not be a psychiatrist. We cited the one case where the defendant had two psychiatrists, but also had a neurologist to testify. And it was held reversible error for the trial judge to indicate through some questioning of the neurologist that the judge really dismissed them as having relevant testimony in regard to the defendant's condition.
So you view condition, which is the word that appears in the model jury charge, to be the word that the court should be thinking about in determining this issue that before us today? Condition?
Your Honor, I think that's perfectly appropriate, and certainly we don't wish to demean any person appearing before the bar. All should be treated fairly and justly. The critical issue is should the verdict be based on reliable evidence? And in this instance in particular, no lay witness could say that when the defendant fired that gun, that he was suffering from a condition that had the capacity to and did negatively prevent him from acting with purpose or knowledge. That's a subject matter that requires expert testimony. This court has held that a jury cannot be left to speculate, and there are some topics that are so esoteric that expert testimony is mandatory before a matter can go to the jury. That's the Fortin case. And one of the cases it cited was a case called Malarney from the Appellate Division, where an individual in a civil matter had to present expert testimony concerning the esoteric matter of his mental condition and how that affected his claim. So
the model jury charge uses the phrase mental functioning in different spots. your view on that?
I think that that's appropriate language, Your Honor, because that's really what the bottom line is here. Justice Hoffman's question earlier to one of the counsel was about whether all the same lay evidence would go in a case where the matter was presented to the jury under the ordinary jury instructions. We agree that that's the case, that the issue here is, should the jury be specifically told to weigh a mental disease or defect as impacting the defendant's mental state in the case? In our view, that requires expert testimony.
Questions?
And just very quickly, Justice Noriega asked how the state would argue the case if the issue was presented to the jury. I think there's two things, Your Honor. And we emphasized in our brief the fact that there was a recording of the telephone call. It's not just the words that might appear on the transcript. It's the tone of voice. You would pick up a lot from hearing how the defendant talked to his girlfriend. And I think just from reading the transcripts, there's definitely a suggestion that the defendant was trying to urge the girlfriend to support his defense. For instance, claiming that there was a second shot and that she heard it, an implication that she rejected. And also, the other thing is, when the gun was found, it wasn't in the holster that the girlfriend's father had seen a few weeks earlier. It was wrapped in a blanket, which was hidden in the trunk. Certainly, these are facts that the state would rely on to show that even if this individual suffers from delusions,
all of that did come into evidence, right?
Pardon?
All of that did come into evidence, correct?
Yes, it did.
Okay, so it's just how the state would have argued, but the state did get to present all the evidence that it wanted to here.
Yes, they did.
And it wouldn't be a countervailing expert saying that there was no diminished capacity. It would just use the facts in the case to argue that it isn't enough in this circumstance to rise to the level of proof.
I think that there's two answers to this, to that, Your Honor. Number one, the state, if the state believed that the issue had been injected to the case, could have presented its own witness. However, I don't know that that was necessary. The defendant, we disagree, even under Humanic, the federal case, the defendant has a burden of production. And Humanic said that that's constitutional. So if the defendant put on an expert who said that his delusions were such that he could not form purpose, he could not knowingly pull the trigger on the gun, the state could cross-examine that witness. And if the state chose to, the state could rest on its cross-examination of that expert in and the lay evidence in conjunction to say that the defendant did in fact have the appropriate mens rea and was guilty of murder.
Without an expert.
Without its own expert, but
I don't mean to belabor this, but your point there would be that the jury could come to the conclusion without the state's expert testimony that this individual was not suffering from diminished capacity.
Yes, because the defendant has the burden of production on the issue.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement.